And we are going to go back now to Lisa Shannon, the founder of Run for Congo Women, who was featured actually this weekend at the E-Convergence. And today we're playing the Coltan Cell Phones and the Crisis in the Congo. So Lisa Shannon, founder of the Run for Congo Women.
I was so honored to be included in this piece on Coltan. I think it's a piece that, I'm asked so often, like, you know, what's really fueling the conflict here? And it's clearly the minerals. There's no question about that. I think in any of these conflicts, you can follow the money trail. And in this case, it's coltan, diamonds, gold. Congo is widely considered one of the wealthiest countries on the planet in terms of natural resources. So it's not coincidental that it's been host to the world's deadliest war since World War II. I've been asked to talk about the human element of the conflict. So just to frame it, I'd like to share a few stories with you about people that I met in Congo. In particular, I'll tell you the story, a story of a very dear friend of mine now. She's someone that we sponsored through Run for Congo Women, and I met in Congo. She was a nurse, her husband a schoolmaster. They were at home one day, and they were at home one day. She was cooking dinner, and the FDLR, the Interahamwe, showed up at her house. This is the militia that's responsible for the Rwandan genocide that was pushed over the border into Congo after the genocide and has continued to terrorize people. It's a militia that's really a lot of other militias' excuse for existing. So they asked her to feed them. She did. They demanded money. So she gave them everything she had, which was $120. But they wanted more money. They got her husband and demanded more money from him. When he said they didn't have anything else, they started to beat him. And Generose, my friend, started screaming for help, and also to warn her neighbors, because it's a code in Congo, if the Interahamwe is attacking, that you cry out to warn other people so they can run and hide. Because she did that, they killed her husband immediately. They shot him as punishment. And then they told her to put her leg up on a chair, and they cut it off with machetes. There were six children present, so they took the leg and cut it into six pieces, threw it in the fire, and then commanded that the children eat the leg. One of her sons, 9 years old, refused to do that. He said, you know, I've already seen you kill my father. I'm not going to do it. And they said, well, then you better pray, because it's going to be the last thing you do. And he said, I'm not going to do that either. I don't like you. I don't like what you've just done. I'm not going to. So they shot him in the head. When Generose told me that story, then they rounded up the family, and they put the family in the hut and torched it. So they would have burned her family alive had her living children not pulled her out and saved her. When I asked her about that, she told me on the same day they had killed her next-door neighbors, and there was a wedding happening next door as well. So after they attacked her home, they went to the wedding party. They raped and killed the bride and then rounded up the entire bridal party, which was 46 people, and burned them all alive. So that's the baseline of violence in Congo. When we talk about the violence in Congo, we are talking about the most extreme violence that exists on the planet. It's violence that is designed to destroy the human spirit, categorically. So when we talk about the human elements of the crisis, right now 5.4 million people have died. That's 45,000 people a month dying. 5.4 million, actually, is the figure that was put together by the International Rescue Committee and published last January 2008, which means if their numbers hold, that the death toll today would be closer to 6.3 million. Half of those are children under the age of five. The interesting thing is that most of those are not violent deaths. What you have when you have this kind of violence taking place is people running away from the militias and hiding in the forest. And when they hide in the forest, what happens is actually, if you look at the definition of genocide, one of the few marks of genocide is deprivation of conditions necessary for life. That's what you see happening in Congo. So what's happening in Congo is not a genocide, but you see, if you look at the list of acts that qualify as genocide, everything on that list is happening in Congo, minus the intent to wipe out a group based on ethnicity or religion. So I'll tell you a story of one other woman, Venciana. Her family lived in an area where there were a lot of attacks, so they would go at night and hide in the forest. And she was pregnant, and she gave birth to her baby in the forest, but the baby was really weak, and the baby died after a day. So when I went to Congo and I talked to Congolese mothers, almost all of them had had children die. And the most common story of children dying was, we were hiding in the forest, the child got sick and died within a day or died within a week, and we couldn't access medical care. So actually, only 2% of the deaths in Congo are violent deaths. The rest of them are due to easily preventable stuff. Malnutrition, diarrhea, malaria. Mostly because people are so displaced, they can't access their food. I mean, people running to sleep next to the Congolese army and then go back to their fields to farm during the day, just so that they can be safe. So when I learned about this situation, I heard about it on Oprah. She did a 20-minute segment on the Congo, and I started reading more. And there was one story in particular that really struck me. A woman was talking about having been dragged away to the forest, and she was begging for her life. And the militia said, even if we killed you, what would it matter? You're not human. You're like an animal. Even if we killed you, you would not be missed. And what struck me about that is that in a lot of ways, the world agrees with that militia, that we don't care if these people die. And so I felt like, okay, I just need to come up with one simple thing I can do to send the opposite message. I've never done anything like this before. I don't know how to do it. I've never fundraised. I've never done any public speaking. I'm just going to kind of make it up as I go along. But just anything, any one thing I can think of to send that opposite message of, like, we care, I care. At least I care, and I can do something. So I started Run for Congo Women. Basically, I just decided the first year to do a 30-mile trail run here in Portland. I was a really wimpy runner. I'm a very slow runner. I've had, like, grandmas and their fat dogs walk past me on the trail. I'm so slow. But I just did it. 5 miles was a long run at the time, but I just trained actually in secret for 4 months because I was afraid I couldn't do it. But I just kind of, like, kept going and then started talking with people about what was happening in Congo. In the first year, I ran alone and raised $28,000 to sponsor women through Women for Women International, who provide basically a person-to-person, woman-to-woman sponsorship program where you can write letters to women, you can sort of give them some encouragement, and then they get business skills, they're able to rebuild. So a lot of these people who have been displaced, who are running away from militias, now they have options to actually build a business so that their kids aren't dying because they can't feed them, So it really does address, in a very tangible way, the issue of those deprivations of conditions necessary for life. So it grew from there because, as it turns out, unlike the popular media has assumed, when people in the United States, people around the world, hear about what's happening in Congo and we actually have the opportunity to know about it, we want to do something, people care, we're human beings, So as people heard about what I did, other people joined in, and it's really grown from there. Last year we had 1,700 people across the country participate in a Run for Congo Women. We, up until yesterday, had raised $400,000 and sponsored more than 1,000 women, and now, hopefully, with our appearance on Oprah, I've heard sponsorships are through the roof for women in Congo. So it's been a way for me to just try to build a movement for Congo, one woman at a time, and then what I've tried to do is leverage the clout that we've built through all these women and men coming together running for Congo Women and take that to the pouring rain, early in the morning and talk to all our friends, and we can raise money, then you need to appropriate more money for Congo. We need to give Congo more money. We need transparency initiatives to address the mining issues. We need the Congolese military to be paid so that they are actually responsible to someone and won't rape. And we need a comprehensive plan to deal with these militias. So we've tried to use the clout that we've built through this humanitarian effort to see policy changes that will lead to a lasting impact in Congo.
You take wine to forget about time. You create a world of your own where the truth will never be known. Well, brother, don't you know now that you're killing yourself and nobody else? Why don't you quit it now? Yeah, why don't you quit it now? You better quit it now.
Miriam Makeba, you've just been listening to Lisa Shannon, the founder of Run for Congo Women, speaking at the eConvergence this past weekend. We got to make it, Miriam Makeba.